Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, March Madness edition. In this episode, I talk with Andy Challenger of Challenger Gray and Christmas about his company's assessment that the 2015 NCAA men's basketball tournament may end up costing $1.9 billion in terms of lost wages paid to distracted and unproductive workers. But first, a conversation with Courtney Banghart, the head coach of the Princeton University women's basketball team. The Tigers head into postseason play as one of two remaining undefeated teams in college basketball. Yet for all the noise and deserved praise coming out of Lexington, Kentucky, the Princeton women march into the madness as an underdog. I asked Coach Banghart if she was disappointed that the NCAA selection committee made her team an 8 seed, even though the 30-0 Tigers advanced through the regular season, beating opponents by an average margin of victory of 24.9 points.
Well, you know, last night, first of all, anytime you get an opportunity to be in the NCAA tournament, you're thrilled. It's such a hard thing to do. It's such a great event, and it's only the best 64 teams. It's not based on anything about your athletic budget, your football team. It's based on how you played that year. So, thrilled to be in the tournament. You know, we thought we had earned a higher seed. All we really cared about was trying to host, and that means we had to be a top 4 seed. Once we didn't host, we don't care about our seed. That's kind of ego-driven, and we don't care about that. We care about our matchup. And our matchup with Green Bay is a great matchup. It's two of the best mid-major programs in the country, and two teams that play really well on offense and play really tough on defense and have a lot of really good players on the roster. So it's going to be a good battle.
Do you feel as if your seeding in the NCAA tournament is ultimately an indictment of the Ivy League?
I think the Ivy League across 1 through 8, it hurt us that teams really, that the middle of the league and the bottom of the league really didn't have a strong enough RPI, both in terms of the way they scheduled in the non-conference and then the results that they had throughout the year. That absolutely hurt us because it affects obviously your RPI when 14 of your games are against teams that didn't have a great year. So, you know, unfortunately, I don't think the Ivy League hurt you every year. I think this was a particular year that it didn't help us.
Yeah, recently there was an article in the Boston Globe that quoted Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris, and they asked her about why the Ivy League refrains from some of the publicity that its larger counterparts like the Big Ten and SEC have embraced. And she said that, you know, nothing's going to change that and that you can be highly competitive in Division I athletics and still have the true student-athlete experiences. Do you feel like the Ivy League could be doing more to promote its athletes and teams?
You know, I think that puts me in a tough spot, I have to admit. I think the fact that our men's soccer team at Princeton, who was a co-champion in the Ivy League men's soccer this year and didn't get a bid into the NCAA tournament, whereas the NCAA tournament field selected instead 7 ACC teams, right? And then on the men's basketball side, that Yale basketball had a co-championship and didn't make the NIT. You know, on our side, being 30-0 in a very historic season and got an 8 seed, I think it does challenge our league and say basically 1 through 8, top to bottom, all across the East Coast, as well as our leadership, that national and regional significance matters. And what can we on our campuses and as a league do to contribute to national and regional significance? And I'm not certain that we have answered that question well enough yet.
And this is your 8th season as the head coach of the women's basketball team at Princeton, and you've had incredible success in that time, and you've been able to recruit talent away from some real powerhouse programs like, you know, USC, UCLA. So what is it that you're able to sell about the experience of Princeton and the Ivy League?
Yeah, you know, as an Ivy League alum, I have to say the Ivy League is the best of the best, and I think it looks at, most of all, it's a collegiate environment. So our students and our athletes, they're all one and the same. And they all live and study and play and socialize on the same campus. And it's not siloed experiences where, because you happen to have supreme talent athletically, your collegiate experience is different than it would be of your peers. Right? Our students' athletes love that. They love that they can compete in the top 25. They can compete in the NCAA tournament. But they can really value their experience here as a part of the general population. And I think that's really special because, you know, honestly, when you're 30 years old, very few people care that you played a college sport. What they care about, you know, what you care about is what you're doing with your life and how much you value your collegiate experience. And it's just, different things matter as you get older. And I think that Princeton has a wonderful opportunity because you love it while you're here and you love it when you leave. and I think that makes it a great sell.
And before you joined the coaching fraternity, you worked at a private high school in Virginia. And in your experience, is the old adage true that coaching is the highest form of teaching?
Absolutely. You know, you said that well. You know, I was a teacher. I've only taken a paycheck for teaching or coaching. One of my summers after Dartmouth, after my junior year, I worked at St. Paul's summer program where I taught biology and coached. And then, of course, my other off term, I coached the varsity boys tennis team at my high school. My brother was the captain. That was kind of neat. And then at Episcopal, I taught biology and psychology. I was the girls' athletic director. I was basketball and tennis coach. So I've only taken a paycheck for education in my whole life, and that's the zone I belong in. And it just so happens that the basketball court is my classroom.
And you both played and coached basketball at Dartmouth College in my hometown of Herndon, New Hampshire. And as a Granite Stater yourself, what was it like playing and working in such familiar surroundings?
You know, New Hampshire's my home. My parents still live there. And, you know, I vacation there in the summer. And Dartmouth, especially now that I get to go back every year, it's a place that so warmly embraced me as a student, so warmly embraced me as an assistant, and now so warmly embraced me as an alum. And you just never forget where you started, never. And if you do, then you're missing a huge part of your foundation. And so New Hampshire, both at South Eagan High School, which I think framed a lot of what I stand for, and then at Dartmouth, which challenged me and helped me grow on so many levels, I'm so grateful for both of those places. And then the fact that New Hampshire still feels like home is such a wonderful thing to say. Now, do I desire to live in those winters anymore? No. But do I desire to spend at least part of every one of my summers there forever? Yes. And so it probably won't be my residence ever again, but it will always have my heart.
All right. Last question. Fair enough about the weathers. Last question. At Sauhegan High School in Amherst, you were a multi-sport star athlete. And when you're out on the recruiting trail today, is it harder to find student athletes who don't just specialize in one single sport?
It is. And here's why. People are asked to make decisions so early in their athletic career. When I was doing it, people weren't making me make those decisions. And if they did, this is the flat truth. If I had to make a decision at the age of 12 what sport I was going to pursue, I would have pursued tennis. I was best at tennis at 12, and then I became best at soccer from the age of 13 until probably the age of 18. And basketball was the sport that I loved the most. So I was able to sort of get, you know, win state championships and play regionally and nationally in tennis. I was able to be a high school All-American in soccer, but my heart always was with basketball, so I got to still play it. Whereas now, I think we put too much pressure on these kids at 12 and say, boy, what club are you going to do? Where are you going to spend all your summers? Where are you going to spend your camp money? Which sport? And that would have been really detrimental to my career, both as a student athlete and now, of course, as a professional. So I'm so grateful that I grew up a little bit before today's time. Having said that, our best player, Blake Dietrich from Wellesley, Massachusetts, is also a lacrosse player. She's a top 10 lacrosse player out of high school. Chose to play basketball at Princeton and joins the lacrosse team as soon as our season is over. So she's playing two sports at the highest level, both teams at Princeton are in the top 25 nationally. And she just refused to choose a sport. And I think when you set the rules, you know, and you stand behind them, good things can happen. And Blake is obviously to this day thrilled that she didn't give up one and that she still plays both. So Blake and I, ironically, are quite similar, like our lead guard and her coach. But for all the student athletes that might be listening or any of the parents, you know, I think it's more detrimental than helpful to have your kids choose too soon. The skills I learned, hand-eye coordination with tennis, footwork and soccer, absolutely contributed to my basketball talent. So I think it's harder to recruit that way now because people are, you know, deciding so early, but it's an advantage when I'm recruiting if a kid has played multiple sports.
Well, Princeton is certainly the beneficiary of the fact that you did not choose tennis at the age of 12, Coach.
So am I. I mean, that's a pretty independent pursuit, and I think I'm best in the collective whole.
Well, thanks for taking the time to answer a few questions, and good luck versus Green Bay this weekend, and hopefully that undefeated streak keeps rolling.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for your coverage and for bringing me back home for at least a phone call.
Coach Banghart and the Princeton Tigers opened the NCAA tournament Saturday with a first-round matchup against the number 9 seed, the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, with the winner most likely moving on to face the top-seeded Maryland Terrapins. My next guest, Andy Challenger, is a vice president at the global outplacement and business coaching consultancy Challenger Gray and Christmas, We spoke about how March is one of the most unproductive months of the year for workers and why that isn't necessarily such a bad thing. Your company, Challenger Gray and Christmas, estimates that this year's March Madness could end up costing $1.9 billion in terms of lost wages. How did you exactly arrive on this number?
So we use a methodology where we first look at the number of American workers we think are going to be participating in March Madness this tournament season. Looking at a couple of different studies, we have, on average, we come to the number 77.7 million Americans that plan on participating in March Madness. Then, you know, we look just for a very conservative estimate. If every one of those individual workers spends on average 1 hour of their day at work over this two-week period, researching picks, filling out their brackets, organizing office pools within the workplace, or watching and streaming games live on their computers at work, then with an average hourly wage of $24.78, that's where we come up with the $1.9 billion figure. So in fact, we think it's a pretty conservative estimate.
Yeah, I was going to say, your CEO, John Challenger, has estimated or has said that the $1.9 billion loss is conservative. And why exactly is that number conservative?
There's a lot of people that spend significantly more than 1 hour of their work time concentrated on March Madness activities. But also, we think this is going to be a bigger March Madness than we've seen in the past because of this great story from Kentucky. A lot of casual sports fans and observers are going to be tuning in this year that otherwise might not have.
And the good news for productivity's sake there is that Kentucky, I don't think, tips off until late at night on either Thursday or Friday. So the workforce dodges a bullet with that one.
It's so true. You know, otherwise, we could expect basically zero economic output from the state of Kentucky if you came with playing during work hours.
And it's, you might have already said this, but when the tournament does tip off, the field of 64, round of 64, tips off Thursday afternoon at 12:15 with Notre Dame versus Northeastern. What exactly are the estimates for how many million Americans will be watching, and how has that number grown over the last few years?
So that number has just grown exponentially because today it's not only people sitting at desktop computers that have access to these streaming feeds of NCAA tournament games. There's also people with smartphones, people with tablets that might not necessarily even be at a computer, but are out in the field that can now be watching. So that's a number that's grown significantly.
And the idea of having a 9-to-5 job, that idea, that concept doesn't necessarily apply to all workers nowadays. So the theory is also that even though people might not be working when the games are going on Thursday and Friday, they can make up that work at other times.
You know, that's a piece of it. Everybody can always stay a little bit later and do a little bit more work if they're salaried to make up that time. But often people forget a huge chunk of the American workforce is paid hourly and is clocking in and clocking out. Over half, 52% of Americans, in fact, are on an hourly schedule.
But for employers, the loss of productivity is not necessarily a bad thing. Why is that?
You know, at the end of the day, we actually think that $1.9 billion figure is a pretty good deal for employers. The March Madness is a unique opportunity for employees to get together, especially from other departments, and talk about something other than the daily business item. And if employers were to try to ban all March Madness activities in the workplace, it would be such a cost in the long run in terms of camaraderie and loyalty and company culture that those would far outweigh the short-term losses that you experience in productivity during the two-week tournament.
And your company is Chicago-based. Do I have that right?
Yep, based in Chicago.
Does that mean Badgers, Buckeyes, Spartans, Boilermakers, Hoosiers, Hawkeyes, or Terrapins?
We got a lot of choices. Luckily, it's a good year for us. But my mom is a Badgers fan. Got a lot of
family from Wisconsin, so they've got my vote for number one spot this year.
And we can assume that if Wisconsin marches on past this weekend, that the state of Wisconsin will remain unproductive for the next few weeks.
Of course. Of course. There hasn't been any team that's in a specific state. You can expect some geographical shutdowns wherever they are.
And it's funny because is there any other event in American sports that is at all similar to March Madness? Do you find that there's a similar lull in productivity with any other sporting event in this country? You know, the Super Bowl happens on a Sunday. Other major sporting events happen at night. Is March Madness kind of on its own when it comes to the loss of productivity at the workplace?
Certainly for any specific event, at one time in such a short period and the number of people that are participating, March Madness is unique. Something that often draws comparisons it's much longer and spread out, but fantasy football has some diehard players. It's not as many users that are participating. The people that get into fantasy football spend a lot of time, and often a lot of time that they work on their teams at work, reading, researching about it, and since it's over a 15-week season, the economic impact of that is actually pretty big, but it's usually just down to a handful of employees.
It would be interesting for in the future. Your company has been doing this for a few years where you've been monitoring the loss of productivity, but it would be interesting in the future to also try to gauge how much money exchanges hands in official or unofficial office pools, because we know that it's not just a loss of productivity that occurs during March Madness, but it's also a lot of gambling that takes place, most of it small scale, but some of it large scale and illegal.
Yeah. And you know what? It's certainly something worth trying to estimate. Hard to, because it's very little information about what's going on inside each office. But some workplaces have to be particularly concerned about that. Particularly financial institutions have a lot of worries about internally gambling going on. So what we recommend is that offices hold their own pools, have brackets sent out to everybody that's free to participate in, and the winner just gets a gift card or something at the end, or the entire team that they come from gets a free pizza party lunch. Those types of pools people can participate in actually really do cut down on inter-office gambling.
But there's really no way for the federal government or employers to monitor these types of transactions. Is that right?
So difficult. Very little transparency into what's going on within work hours, but also often people will organize these pools after work and just no way to track it.
So, Andy, if you were a gambling man, which I'm not saying you are, but if you were, who would you be putting your money on in this year's March Madness?
It's so hard not to go with Kentucky this year. But I think I like the momentum the Badgers have, and I think I'm going to have Wisconsin as my number one pick, even though I'm very concerned about Kentucky.
Well, you don't have to worry about them until the Final Four. On Wisconsin, Andy. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And finally, Forbes released their list of the most valuable teams in college basketball, with the University of Louisville holding down the top spot for the fourth consecutive year. I spoke with Forbes Sports business writer Chris Smith about these rankings. Chris, what makes the Louisville men's basketball program so valuable?
I mean, it's a lot of things. Like a lot of teams that they've succeeded well on the court, which means that they're kicking off a ton of money to their conference. Over the last 6 years, which is the period that the NCAA uses for its distributions, Louisville has been in 19 tournament games, not counting championships, which is right up there. I think it's, second most behind Michigan State, tied with a few other programs. And then just, at the school level, they're bringing in a ton of money. Obviously, they opened up the new KFC Yum Center a few years ago, and that's basically a pro-style arena. Tons of concession sales happened there. They made over $1 million. just from, you know, programs, concessions, parking, things like that last season. And then with that new arena came a lot of money from their alumni. And so you see that Louisville brings in, you know, over $20 million a year in contributions from fans and alumni, and that really puts them over the top. So last year generating revenue over $40 million. And, you know, in our methodology of looking at the different areas they create value, that puts their value up to just over $38 million last year.
Where does all that revenue go? Because we know, fairly or unfairly, it's not ending up in the hands of the players.
Right. Players see absolutely none of that, at least in terms of take-home. Some of it goes to the players in the form of uniforms, facilities, athletic scholarships. And so athletic scholarships are one area. Last year, a typical year, I was looking at about $400,000 in basketball scholarships. Some money goes to basic expenses, rent, facility maintenance, you have coach staffing. Rick Pitino and his staff, they'll take a few more $1 million. And then the profits that are left over, and last year Louisville had a profit of $24.2 million. A lot of that goes into, that all goes into the athletic department, into their coffers, and they use that money to support other sports. So, for instance, swimming or soccer or baseball, sports that don't bring in enough revenue to cover their expenses, sports like basketball and football in the fall are responsible for generating the income to support those sports and the scholarships for those athletes.
Chris, in the past, has this list elicited much negative feedback directed towards the NCAA in terms of one more reason why college athletes need to be compensated?
Nothing especially widespread, at least so far, that I'm aware of. But I know that, you know, whenever we write about the business of college sports, whether it's looking at how much money coaches stand to make and performance bonuses, you know, from doing well in the tournament, or looking at these giant stadiums and arenas that colleges are building for their teams, that's sort of the natural reaction from a large contingent of sports fans is that, you know, how is this fair? How can there be so much money and the players get none of it? And I don't think that's an unfair question to ask or an unfair criticism to make. Though it's worth noting that, you know, at the end of the day, there is, you know, these wildly profitable teams are a very small segment within college basketball. If you look at our list alone, you drop down to profits under $10 million. You know, at the total spot on the list, at Michigan State, making a profit of $8.5 million last year. So I think that there are examples of wildly profitable teams where you can make the argument of it being incredibly unfair for players not to get anything. But as you drop down, you see that it becomes much more difficult for these teams to make enough money for the entire athletic department to come out ahead at the end of the day.
Were there many or any teams in major Division I college basketball that lost money last year?
It's actually a difficult question. The answer to that is yes. There are a bunch of teams that wind up losing money. But it becomes tricky to figure out exactly how much they're losing, simply because of the way that the Department of Education's financial reporting standards work. They don't require that teams report exact losses. So if, you know, your basketball team lost money, you can kind of play with the revenue numbers to make it look like that the loss was zero. So, you know, it evens out, which is a funny thing. But that's because of the Department of Education's filing. It's being used just for Title IX purposes, so they're just interested in the spending side of things. But to answer your question, yes, teams lost money. For instance, Connecticut reported losing money last year. You know, and that's a team that just won a national championship. And that's not a new thing that they lost money. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. It's surprising to hear that a school that has as reputable a basketball reputation as the University of Connecticut reports losing money when they just won the national championship. I wonder, and you might not know this, what the reason for that loss was, especially during a national championship campaign.
I don't know specifically for Connecticut and for last year. But I could tell you that, you know, in my experience, I'm just looking at these numbers, a lot of times when teams make a deep tournament run, they actually see their profitability go down in the short run just because they take on increased costs in the form of travel, lodging, and food for their team. You get coach bonuses. You know, a lot of coaches, if they go all the way to win, they get bonuses throughout the tournament. So if you go all the way to win the national championship, that adds up pretty quickly. And it's not only for the head coach, but also for the assistant coaches. So there's a lot of upfront costs there. And in theory, that gets paid off down the line as, you know, your merchandise sales continue, as the exposure helps bring more students or more student-athletes into the university, that, you know, over time it'll pay off and you can kind of reap the benefits in the long term.
How much of a correlation is there between value and success on the court? So if you broke down the brackets based on the financial success of programs, how different would the results look?
It's an interesting question. And I think for the most part you see that there is something of a correlation between the two. But only because, you know, the most valuable programs are also the teams that are able to spend the most. And then, you know, sort of, I think the correlation is more along the lines of spending and success. You know, the teams able to spend the most can bring in the best coaches. They can afford to do the most recruiting, provide the best facilities for their student-athletes. And so I think that you see a correlation along those lines, more so than, you know, what we might call the valuable teams. Though obviously there's a very, very similar list there.
Would fans be surprised by any universities on the list this year, schools that they wouldn't otherwise think would be ranked amongst the top most valuable college basketball programs?
Maybe. I mean, there's a few. Like Northwestern is number 19 on the list this year. They've actually been hanging around, 22, 23 in the past years, and this year they kind of made the jump up. But that's one that you might not expect because that's not a major, you know, traditional basketball program. Others, you have your smaller schools like Xavier and Marquette. Dayton just missed the cut, and those guys are always hanging around. And I think those are the interesting ones because those aren't coming from your typical power conferences. So they're not relying on, you know, massive TV deals to generate revenue, like, you know, your ACC teams or your Big Ten teams or SEC teams. So those would be the ones I'd consider the most surprising. And then the one surprise I think this year from a power conference would be Alabama, just because they haven't been performing all that well on the court recently. They just fired their head coach at the end of the regular season. But they're number 14 on the list this year, value of just over $12 million.
Can you equate any of that to the success of their football program?
Actually, that's a really interesting question, and you might be able to. I can't say for sure. I have zero evidence of that. But I know that a lot of times that, you know, when one team succeeds, the athletic department as a whole stands to benefit from that, especially because a lot of times what these athletic departments will do is take, you know, say, merchandise revenue and portion that out to sports, not necessarily from where, you know, the direct source. So, for instance, you know, sold at a football game or sold at a basketball game, but rather just portion out sort of a rough idea of, you know, how much each sport generally is, or would generally be responsible for. And so, you know, and if the pie grows, then basketball slice of that pie will grow along with it. So it's possible that's what's happening there, but I can't say for sure.
Last question, Chris. As people feverishly fill out their brackets these last few hours before the round of 64 begins, would you recommend anyone using your Forbes list as a determining factor in who moves on to the next round?
We actually just did a story on this on Monday as well, basically looking at basketball spending as an indicator. And I would don't use it as the perfect guide is what I would recommend, because I do it every year, and it seems to do reasonably well in the early rounds. You know, taking the top spending teams tend to succeed in the first round, even the second round. And I think that's expected that your teams from the bigger conferences, your more established teams, teams with the better coaches, are going to have some success early. But what I found is that you really don't want to rely on that late in the game, because, you know, once you get into the later portion of the tournament, you're talking about top team versus top team. And I think the spending differences there are marginal and aren't really enough of a guide. And we've seen in the past that it just hasn't been an effective way of predicting tournament outcome.
So
I'd say, you know, it's something to keep in mind maybe early on, but definitely not towards the end.
So if people do choose to use the Forbes list as a factor in who moves on to the next round, you'd prefer if they didn't blame you directly?
Absolutely, unless it winds up being perfect, in which case I'll take all the credit.
All right, Chris. Well, Chris Smith, thanks a lot for the time, and enjoy the madness.
Great. You too. Thanks, everyone.
That's it for this special March Madness edition of the View My Seats podcast. My thanks once again to Coach Courtney Banghart, Andy Challenger, and Chris Smith. I'm John Lord, wishing everyone out there an unproductive week of work. Thanks for listening.